This program is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks. You'll find over 100,000 titles in just about every genre. And if you want to listen to Katie Kitamura's The Long Shot and help keep this wonderful show going, sign up at www.audiblepodcast.com/bat for a free audiobook, a 30-day trial, perhaps a hug in the future. Because sometimes you need more in life than fresh bruises and a black eye to confront the dying remnants of your physicality.
I am the song that birds are singing. I am the breeze.
Okay, so I am here with Katie Kitamura, who is most recently the author of Gone to the Forest. Katie, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So, I have to get right into it from the very beginning, because I was reading this book, and the first few pages of Gone to the Forest, there's this reference to a radio, as well as a house sitting on the edge of the river. And as someone who is reading all the modern library classics, including Napalm's Bend in the River, I said to myself, isn't that interesting? And then I read a reference to Sargasso weed, which made me say, oh, well, maybe this is sort of a Gene Reese White Sargasso Sea response to Napalm. And you know, I'm wondering about this because there are certainly a lot of similarities to Bend in the River. You have, of course, you know, the unnamed country, the rebellion, the subjugation of women, a not so bright and condescending young heir. So, you know, you also, however, feature this vicious volcano, a dying father, a terrible gang rape. And so I must ask you, first and foremost, you know, was this at any point intended as a sort of Gene Reese-like response to Napalm? How was A Bend in the River a starting point for this book in any way?
I read A Bend in the River before I started writing the book. I don't think it was necessarily formulated as a response to it directly, although I like that reading very much, and I would love to think that I'd written a Gene Reese-like response to it. I mean, I think partially the reason you get that sense of Gene Reese against Napalm is because the book is trying to write from the fragments of this kind of long legacy of colonial literature in particular. So, and Gene Reese, more generally, is a writer I admire incredibly.
Oh, yeah.
Not just White Sargasso Sea, but also all the other novels. So her prose style, her directness, her kind of sense of melancholy, her, you know, I think courage is a word that can easily sound sort of sentimental in the context of fiction, but incredibly courageous fiction in writing about women. So yeah, that's probably not a direct, but it's probably in there in some way.
Well, let's talk about such side characters as the Wallaces, who reminded me also very much of the historian and his wife in Bend in the River. You have a situation where they're described as marginal people of no interest to his father. He is, of course, being Tom, this protagonist who kind of mimics the, you know, scummy figure in Bend in the River. They immediately ask Celeste to prepare a meal for supper, and I'm wondering, because the Wallaces, to a large degree, don't have that dimensionality that you would normally expect from the sort of imperialist, colonial type of figures that tend to populate these kinds of novels. I was wondering if the Wallaces were sort of an effort on your part to invert the dimensionality, giving more dimensionality to, say, you know, people like Jose, as opposed to these imperialists who really assume that all natives are there for to be immediately be put to work and so forth.
So I think The book as a whole, the context of it is pretty wide because it's a combination of multiple colonial settings and multiple histories. And so it's this fragmented, collage-like panorama that's, you know, it's not set in a specific time, therefore includes multiple times.
Yes.
So I think against that, I wanted to focus very, very tightly on what happened to a single family, and ultimately Celeste and Jose, although they are servants, they're also family on this farm. So all the other characters outside of that became secondary in some way. And also, I suppose it was a novel that's about power and not just the relationship between whites and non-whites, but also amongst, also class between the different white settlers. So I think in that particular characterization, I was interested in drawing a distinction between how the old man, the father in the novel, perceives himself against the other white colonials, and how he makes distinctions. So in a way, they are just a foil to the old man's arrogance.
You mentioned reading Napalm before writing this book, and the question I have is, well, to what degree did you know that, oh, it's time to stray, I've got it in my head, I'm very familiar with what he has done, and now I can sort of carry on with this more metaphorical or more minimalist approach to metaphor in your book? At what point did you detract from Napalm, and in what point was he just not even necessary?
I think the unnamed setting in that novel is so distinct, and the way he handles that is very distinct. And I knew that I wanted to do something that was not simply unnamed, but also completely imagined, so that was a kind of distinction I wanted to make from what he had done in that novel. The themes that he writes about obviously are critical, but the prose, I was never influenced by his prose style, for example. There's a host of other writers, I think really European female writers, that I was much more influenced
by. Such as who?
For this particular novel, and it's a kind of funny thing where it changes almost with each product you're writing.
That's no problem.
Your kind of toolkits alter slightly. I think I was reading a great deal of Elfriede Jelinek and Herta Müller. And what I was interested in is, they don't write these beautiful long sentences. They really break language in a lot of ways. And that was what I admired, what I thought was so striking about what they were doing. And I was also curious to see if that was in some way could be used specifically to address a female subjectivity. So there's the sequence in the rape scene in the novel, which is one of the more difficult parts of it. There's a lot of breaks and fragments in that particular section. And I think that's not because I think there is such a long tradition of male narratives and male narrativizing.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that hasn't been made accessible to women in quite the same way historically. And I wondered if that was partially why this fragmentation was interesting to me to try to use.
I wonder if the fragmentation, especially in relation to this rape scene, was interesting to you, specifically because, well, one reads it, and one is, of course, appalled by what's going on, but at the same time, the sentences are informed very much by this need to present this as relatively normal in the confines of this catastrophe. It seems to me that you're someone who would probably really work to get that acceptable level, so it tests the reader, and it suggests almost, I suppose, a cultural relativism or a moral relativism in the way that you describe that action. What did you do to get that particular balance that I'm at least detecting here? To get that situation where, okay, I come in and I'm appalled by it, but at the same time, I'm also being forced to look upon this as this is part of life.
I mean, I wanted to create the kind of the purpose of this rather extravagant volcanic explosion was to create a space where social rules were being suspended, and where you would see, in this case in particular, men taking advantage of that suspension of rules. And I remember before I started writing that sequence, to get the voice of it right, I wanted to try writing in a misogynistic voice, which I thought would be an interesting experiment as a woman.
Yeah.
And I initially thought would be a very difficult or impossible one, but in fact is so easy because misogyny is everywhere around you, and the language of it is everywhere around you. And so some of the things even that the girl says, are a lot of them are in invisible quotation marks. She is kind of quoting a language of chauvinism that she has grown up in. And I know it's a kind of morally ambiguous scene. She, to some extent, seems to instigate what happens. But what I wanted to really look at was, well, first of all, I completely, as you probably will guess, disagree with the notion that a woman can in some way provoke any kind of sexual violence against her. I mean, when, I think it was in this area, do you remember when there was a rapist and they were telling women not to wear short skirts?
Yes.
Was that, I can't remember the specifics of it.
It's been one of those days where my memory is not as reliable as it usually is.
It was somewhere in Brooklyn. I'm not sure.
It was the Park Slope situation.
Notion that a woman by wearing a short skirt would be inviting.
Yes, and there was a huge outcry. Mm.
Yeah. So in some way, I wanted to write a situation where perhaps a reader would think she was responsible for it.
I see.
But you would have to be confronted by the fact that, of course, she's not. That she's a character in a historical period, not contemporary, who perceives her power to be largely sexual because she's been disempowered in so many other ways.
Yeah.
And therefore, she's been shaped by the society that has made her, and she sees a limited range of options available to her precisely because she's been so shaped by that society. But having said all of that, she's really one of my favorite characters in the book. I admire her more than anybody else in the book.
Yes. Was she, and I'm almost kind of adopting the whole the girl situation, was she someone who was so vivid to you that any misogynistic mode that you had to write out of necessity that may have been unsettling to you, that was able to trump the discomfort of writing in that mode? I'm curious how you wrestled with the idea of just writing in a purely misogynistic voice, because when you adopt the tone of someone who something that is absolutely repugnant, you know, if you have any kind of empathy at all, you're going to have difficulties. Or do you get so much into that mode where you're able to sidestep your own particular qualms and concerns and emotions?
So that this particular scene is slightly split in that it seems initially to... It's a kind of relatively close third to her, and it's you're also seeing the responses very clearly of the men who are around her. And then there's a break in it, which is important for me. I mean, I remember at some point, I think people were saying break should be removed, it should run smoothly, but for me the break's quite important. And then it becomes really 100% internal to her point of view. And so when I was writing these kind of really horrific responses that these men were having to her, I always thought that my revenge would be the sequence that followed, which is inside her head.
Yeah.
When I think all of the kind of use of this chauvinistic and misogynistic language is mocking in some way. I mean, she's a character full of self-awareness, so she understands all the weaknesses of that point of view.
Sure.
And I hope it wasn't too much of a polemic in that.
Yeah.
In that second.
No, I don't think it was. But I mean, the question is really just, and I think you've answered it. You know, as an author approaching a repugnant perspective, it's an ongoing debate.
Yeah.
I've had this discussion with China Bieville of like, at what point does an author subconsciously adopt that morality, and how do you deal with that?
It's true, because I think if you don't, I think in this novel in particular, I've tended to write about two things, misogyny and violence, that are extremely foreign to me. I'm not a physically violent person.
You aren't.
Surprisingly.
You came at me with a dagger before we started talking.
So that there was no real moral confusion on my part that by writing this I would become a violent misogynist. And maybe that's what allows you to take a few more risks with being empathetic enough to write what you need to write.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Not a violent person, and yet the long shot was filled, especially with that climactic fight near the end, with all sorts of juicy, grisly violence. So, you know, I mean, I know horror writers who are the nicest people in the world. They will write extremely vicious things on the page. So, is it just empathy from a state of calmness? Is it the Flaubert maxim of, you know, being calm and orderly life so you can be violent and original in your work?
The violence in the first book, The Long Shot, is interesting because I say that I'm not a violent person. But I, as I said a bit earlier, I trained in classical ballet for quite a long time. And that's a form of violence that is enacted on the body that is not necessarily between two people.
Yeah.
So although the violence in The Long Shot takes a form of combat between two men, I really wanted to write about the wear and tear on the body. So strangely, I don't think of that as a particularly violent book, although I've been told by many people that it is.
Well, again, when you're in the heads of these characters, it seems perfectly natural. I mean, are you ever shocked during the stage of revision of what you have set down on the page? Do you have anything along those lines? I know some writers do, but I'm wondering if once you have released the book, you don't look at it again, or you have acclimatized yourself to however and whatever intense qualities are there in a particular project.
That's really interesting. I don't reread the book after it's done. I don't reread it after it's been kind of proofed and everything. And it is interesting that you say that, because I've noticed that I've avoided reading thus far from the two, what are kind of effectively the two set pieces of the novel, which are the scene in the woods and then the rape sequence,
yeah,
which are both the most violent passages of the book. And I haven't even looked at them yet.
Wow.
So I actually don't know what I've written in that sense. That's interesting.
But you're familiar enough to talk about it.
I mean,
some writers are so prolific that they have to take some time to sort out books, but it seems to me that there's more of an intense mnemonic effort on your part to really know your book so that you don't have to confront it later and you can, you know, deal with it if people like me come and talk.
Well, it's interesting because Sarah had asked me if I would consider reading from the rape sequence for an event last week, and it just seemed almost impossible to me. And maybe there'll be a point later, and I mean, I have maybe later down the road I'll feel comfortable reading from it, but it's I don't even know how you would set that up to have it make sense to the audience.
You feel that if you were to read that particular scene, it would lose the specific power and the specific purpose for which it was designed to be read, to be actually understood as prose on the page.
Yeah.
Because it is very nuanced in the way you layer the sentences and all that.
It was interesting because I went through it line by line in the editing stage with somebody, and there were so many. It was interesting because there were references that I thought were clear that were not clear, and it had to be gone through again quite carefully to make sure that it was without being 100% kind of on the nose, but it would still be clear that this was referring to this and this was... I mean, there are nursery rhymes and that kind of thing in that passage. It's... I mean, in a way, I would love to read it because I think it is a piece of prose in the book that I think is the best. But maybe I'm a little anxious about it.
I have, as a matter of fact, read the two previous books that you have written. I know Japanese for Travelers is omitted, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to bring it up, being the sort of brash journalist that I sometimes am. So I've read the three books, and what's interesting to me is that there's this intriguing trajectory. So Japanese for Travelers, you are describing nearly everything from, you know, what's in a store to a pachinko parlor, and you were just so caught in just wanting to describe everything. Then you read The Long Shot, and suddenly you have this extremely stripped down, minimalist, declarative quality to your sentences, but also, oddly enough, a lot of telling more than action, a lot of dialogue. So I read this one, and I say to myself, I wonder how this is going to evolve. And I read them in order, and so it was actually kind of interesting. And I see, well, actually every sentence is devoted to that same kind of, you know, let's keep things to, you know, maybe 4 to 8 words per sentence. But simultaneously, there's a lot of double activity going on. There's a lot of metaphor. And I'm curious as to how you went from this intriguing track of describing everything to stripping it down to taking that stripped down quality and just really reinforcing it with metaphor or the possibility of something beyond the human. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the distinction between the first and the second book is that it's from nonfiction to fiction, and
yeah,
I find fiction much more freeing in a way. And also something...
Freeing, how so?
Well, I have a problem with writing first person, which is something that I would love to get over, because I love so many first person novels, and I think first person narrative is a fantastic way of storytelling. It has a directness and an immediacy that I think is really useful and that I enjoy as a reader. But for me personally, I find that I become so self-conscious when I'm writing in the first person, even in fiction, that it almost becomes crippling, and I think the minute you're self-conscious and you're writing that first draft, or second and third draft, it's really very difficult to continue. So removing the first person from the writing process, I think allowed me to see more clearly what I wanted to get on the page. And I was also more, I think I'm becoming more clear about what I want my prose style to be. So in the first one, in the first novel, The Long Shot, I wanted it to have this kind of rhythmic, physical quality to it, because it was about bodies and it was about a sport. And in this one, I think there's a way in which everything about the novel refers to something else. It is, I don't want to say it's a novel about novels, because it's not necessarily, but I think that use of metaphor, even on the level of the sentence, was really important in a way it wasn't in the first one. Because the Long Shot is, of course, it is a kind of genre, in a way it's a genre book, and it refers to, there are many, many fight novels, but it's a pretty self-contained thing. But this, I think, was something, the Gone to the Forest is something that refers constantly to a discourse that's happening outside of itself, if that makes sense.
I'm wondering, is first person difficult for you because you could only write first person in your own voice? That it's you have difficulties impersonating other people, or you feel that the best way to understand other people is through this sort of omniscient voice?
No, I mean, I actually do not know what my first person voice is.
Really?
So that's and I think this is, I think writing is so interesting because it does always ultimately reflect character flaws and character, nice things about people's character. Yeah. But you know, it always does reflect the character of the author. So often when if I read a book of somebody that I know very well, and if there are things that work exceptionally well and maybe things that I think don't work so well, I think they often can be tied back to certain decisions and things you're capable of doing within your own life, although I know many people would disagree with that.
Yeah.
But that's the way I definitely feel personally. So for me, I cannot write that first person character and not see myself in it in some way, but I don't clearly know what my first person voice would be. So it's a real quandary. So it's something that, I mean, I feel completely comfortable writing characters that are very different to my own experience. And I admit, perhaps it's, if I write it in the first person, I worry that something of myself would seep into it too much. I'm not sure.
Let me try to theorize here. When you see yourself in fiction, whether through first person or possibly through some sort of third person mode, you immediately lose focus or concentration or the ability to grapple towards areas of humanity, such as misogyny or violence or some unnamed nation, that you will absolutely be able to wrestle with using this very concentrated third person mode. You will have, it doesn't seem to me like it's necessarily a matter of control as it is a matter of consciousness for you. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, I think technically I could probably write first person in terms of just prose style. But it's a question of not feeling self-conscious on the page. You know, maybe a couple years from now I will be able to make that firm distinction between the fictional I and the I that is writing that fictional I. But
Personal hang-ups? Is it exposing yourself?
It's funny, because I think books are, you expose yourself so much in a book, but at the same time when you're writing it, I think you have to pretend you don't. And I'm a relatively private person, and I'm quite introverted, really, so I think that's probably, it comes back to your character in some way.
I think maybe it's this. You feel that any persuasive lie you set down on the page to get a reader to believe will somehow have a reader immediately ascribing certain qualities to you personally.
No, it's not that. Okay. I don't worry about the reader. I worry about, because, you know, writing is so much a kind of balance between hubris and total self-loathing.
Of course.
And I think when the eye is on the page, I really tip too much towards the self-loathing, and it becomes impossible for me to continue. So weirdly, I mean, in the kind of incredible narcissism of a writer, I'm not I don't worry about what the reader would think. I don't worry about the reader assuming that's me, but I just worry about looking at the page and seeing myself in it too clearly and then being so appalled that I won't be able to continue writing. I think that's what it is.
So you, it seems, require total confidence when you set out to write a fiction project. Is this also why you choose topics such as, you know, extraordinary fighting, extraordinary upheaval in another land? If you choose something that is so consumed with violence that and remove yourself almost totally from that, or offer a perspective that, you know, you're not going to necessarily have direct first-hand knowledge of, you can therefore have the complete confidence to see it through to the end and to remove yourself entirely from the equation.
Sure, I think that's probably true. Although, you know, ultimately I did discover that so much retroactively, that so much of the long shot is about my own experience training, which I did seriously. I was doing it kind of 4 to 6 hours a day, all through my adolescence. And then Gone to the Forest, I started writing it very shortly after my father died. And I think it was, which was a difficult period for me. And it was really interesting after he died. And I, you know, I have many friends I've talked to about this, but I thought there was such a distinction in getting over the dying versus getting over the death. And in a way, it was such an intense experience watching him die, and I'd never experienced anything like that. And I think, in a way, that was a really deeply traumatizing thing. On a kind of rational level, I missed him tremendously. He was the person I most identified with. We were very similar in our interests and our characters. So I could understand that, because there's such a narrative for understanding how you deal with grief when it means the loss of a person. But I didn't really know how to understand what I had just witnessed in terms of watching him die in front of me, which I think, relatively speaking, is not present in our culture that much. I think the actual physical process of dying. So I think, in a way, the book, although there's much more going on beyond that, but certainly the second half of the book is, to some extent, dominated by this process of dying. So it's a kind of taxonomy of dying. And so I was writing it from a very, very personal place, but I suppose, you know, I didn't write a first-person narrative about somebody, a daughter, watching their father die. I wrote something that was more abstracted and very different, but at the same time it was writing from a very personal place.
Is this also, I suppose, why there's this extraordinary moment where the old man, Tom's father, in Gone to the Forest, is caught up in this pool of ash that's sucking him in, to the point where he becomes a very corporeal element of the environment? He's actually almost no longer a soul. And even the way that you describe a lot of his blood and his interior guts is black, tar, words like that. You know, I'm wondering if, on some level, based off what you were just telling me about your father, whether putting a father into a situation where, well, there is no soul, there is no presence, it's someone who is dying and who is literally indistinguishable from the ash around, was a way of coming to terms with some aspect of what grieving means in our culture, what death means in our culture.
I mean, the kind of, I think specifically with the ash sequence, I was really interested in trying to link the characters very closely to the land itself. Not simply for some kind of overarching poetic sense of, but also because land is property and property is power, and these characters are about power. But beyond that, definitely there's a kind of, which many people I've talked to have experienced this, some have not, but there's a moment just before people die, when they're no longer themselves. They are physical beings that you can no longer entirely recognize the person that you love so deeply. And that's very, very difficult. And there's something also really interesting about the kind of scene, the deathbed scene that takes place, where this person is dying, is incredibly weakened, and yet they have this charisma, because everything
is never underestimate the charisma of someone who's dying. I love that.
Yeah, and I really, really experienced that, and it was not. I mean, I considered my father an incredibly funny and charismatic man, but it was not that charisma that I was seeing. It was a completely different kind of charisma, and almost a tyrannical one, in that, you know, people are constantly, you have to service the dying as they're dying.
A charisma we don't even talk about.
No, too. I mean, I think that's, in a way, something that would be upsetting to many people to hear, but it is, again, every single experience of dying is very different people to witness, I'm sure, but
and everyone has their own different
and they
way
have
of
their
dealing.
Own narrative yeah. of it yeah exactly
so to talk about something that is common to everybody but is also dealt with in different ways,
yeah,
much I as mean, we deal with love and much as we deal with
yeah.
numerous deep feelings,
absolutely.
It's extremely, especially when there's more of a verboten label attached to it.
Sure. I mean, it's this kind of notion of people talk about a peaceful death, and I wonder what that really means, because I think the body often wants to live, but I've just
died
read
peacefully, when in fact they often don't die peacefully.
No, because it's a tremendous... The body has its impulses to live. I mean...
Or he was such a nice guy, which doesn't even begin to get the complexities of any one individual.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I just read this Karl Ove Knausgård's novel, A Death in the Family, which is...
Oh, I've not read this.
I'm sure you know this, the Norwegian writer who's written this six-part, you know, very closely biographical novel, and I've only read the first volume, which I think has just come out in English, and it's about his father dying, and it's, you know, it's a really fascinating book, in part because the kind of his obsession with describing every single detail about that dying process, which in this case takes almost, he talks about cleaning up the house where his father died, and it goes into, you know, it's maybe not hundreds of pages, but certainly dozens of pages describing this cleaning process. But I really recognized it as the mark of somebody who is grieving, because you think, I want to capture every single thing that is happening. And you feel like the most that you can do, the one thing that you have to do is kind of be willing to witness this person's dying and all of its horror, rather than kind of turn it into this beautiful narrative about he let go, he slipped away. I mean, you know, again, I'm sure there are deaths that are like that, but my father did not slip away or just let go in a peaceful way. He really wanted to live. Anyway.
Well, turning to translated works of fiction for the answers to these deep questions, would suggest, I suspect on your part, that, say, Anglophonic literature is not quite cutting the mustard when it comes to actually wrestling with these things. Is that safe to say? Why do you turn to translated works to get truthful answers? Or is your idea to sort of be not just a translator of language, but a translator of theme, to get Western audiences understanding some of these deeper ramifications for the way in which we live?
Right. I mean, I love translated fiction. I think the majority of what I read is fiction in translation. Although, having said that, I'm currently reading Chana Mieville's new novel, and I know you admire his work as well, and I think he's a wonderful writer. And
you're on Railseed. I haven't read that yet.
I'm just started it, and I'm very excited. And it's got a really distinct prose style that is really interesting to me. And I think he's a fantastic writer and an incredibly ambitious and smart writer. Initially, I think I am drawn to translated fiction because I'm interested in the awkwardness that comes out of translation.
The actual brokenness
prose,
of the language.
Yeah, I love that.
That reveals truth.
I love that. I kind of like badly translated books a little bit. I'm really intrigued by them. I'm reading a lot of Clarice Lispector right now, and I really have the sense that the translations are probably good, but for whatever reason are not perfect, or that perhaps, you know, Portuguese to English is a difficult one. But I kind of am so fascinated by that I kind of am compulsively reading the books. So I love the kind of linguistic quality of fiction and translation, and that's actually something I am really trying to get into my prose, although it's directly into English. If I can get some of that that wonderful awkwardness that makes you reconsider how the words are no longer being given to you in a form that is that you take for granted or that you recognize. In terms of, I mean, I do love so many English language writers, and I'd be hesitant to condemn all of English.
Well, I mean, we just talked about China Mieville. Do you think the genre, in the way that it often has eccentric,
should we just move back?
I think we can move back and deal with this. It is raining as we talk. I'm just keeping the tape rolling.
Should I move this table?
Yeah, really fine.
So in terms of English language writers, do you think that perhaps genre permits a lot of these broken linguistic qualities which reveal truth that is kind of on the level of translated fiction? I mean, are there any, I suppose, mainstream or obvious choices that you could cite, or books that, you know, people flock to that actually have these broken qualities, or do you feel there's just something essentially lacking in the homogenization of literature right now, in terms of this language that is broken to reveal something that is true?
I think I'm doing a slightly terrible exclusionary thing where I just for my own purposes and my own kind of fictional project, I'm reading so much stuff in translation that I'm now struggling to think of the most recent English language book that I've read. I mean, China Mieville, I think he's such an interesting writer because he's doing these interesting linguistic things, but he's also so smart.
Yeah.
And so he's dealing with things, he's able to put a level of active thinking and, I mean, you know, not secondhand thinking, but active philosophical thinking into his books. And I don't know if that's because it's science fiction. I suspect he could do that just as easily in outside of genre. I suspect that's his, that's him as a writer. But it is really interesting to me what he's, something like Embassy Town. I mean, he's doing kind of linguistic theory in sci-fi genre. And it has precursive narrative, but it's also got incredibly complex ideas about language. And that.
Have you read Delaney's Babel 17? Because that's kind of like the blueprint that China is sort of working off. Although he did his own.
I mean, there's a real tradition of that in science fiction, and I think it's interesting that so many writers I know, quote unquote literary writers now, are really interested in science fiction as a genre and want to kind of look at that as a form to write in, because I think they realize that you're able to talk about philosophy, politics as well.
Yeah.
Very directly, in a way that, and I don't know why people feel that's difficult to do in a literary novel.
Yes.
I mean, I have to say, I'm not overjoyed by the kind of single guy in Brooklyn dating life novel. It just, although
kind of the offshoots of Lad Lit.
I haven't read enough of them to say that definitively, but I don't really understand the ambitions of that.
Sorry. Wait, what?
A mosquito. I was worried that you were going to get.
The mosquitoes do like me in the summer.
Yeah. No, likewise, I'm very alive to people getting attacked.
I wanted to ask about the volcano and Gone to the Forest, because this unnamed nation does indeed have unrest. And we think at first that the unrest has more to do with the volcano. But then once the volcano has been dealt with, we see that there is a decided political unrest. And I wanted to ask you about this interesting duality of unrest, whether the idea of broaching political unrest came before the volcano, or the volcano came before that. How did the volcano come into the design of this particular narrative? I'm curious.
I mean, the volcano came first. It was the image that, I mean, I think a lot of people start with an image, and that was the image that first contained the kind of seed of the book, is there was a volcano in Chile 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And there were these extraordinary images of the ash kind of drifted into Argentina. And there were these extraordinary images of people kind of up to their waist in ash, wearing goggles and masks, and there was something about it that was completely apocalyptic, but not in a way that I recognized, that felt, that really felt difficult to place either in terms of geographical location or in terms of time. So that was an image that I had in my mind for a year or so. And then from there, I kind of started working out how I wanted to write about it. And I think I was interested in, I wanted to do something that linked the struggle, the land itself, to the struggles of the characters. Again, not hopefully not in a sentimental way, but more because, you know, these fights are about land, and they are about power and money, and that was why I thought if I could kind of give this convulsive sense to the land itself, then that would hopefully provide the kind of, I mean, logically it doesn't make sense in that there's no reason why a volcano would foreshadow a revolution, but I wanted to create a kind of roiling sense of something happening in the place.
Well, this leads me to ask you another question that I was keen on. Clearly, this novel is rooted in metaphor, I would say. And what is intriguing is that you have to deal with a fish farm and a volcano. And it leads me to ask the level of research that you would have to do for a more metaphorical novel. Is it decidedly lesser? Does it get in the way of exploring the dualities, the truths, the violence, etc., power, ambition, what have you? The more research that you do, the more facts that are at your disposal, is this going to get in the way of a novel like Onto the Forest, as opposed to, say, The Long Shot, which is more rooted in, you know, what you experienced, and I think was, I'm guessing at least, was more rooted than tactile information at your fingertips.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I'd freed myself up slightly by creating this little invented world and allowing myself to freely mix different colonial countries. I mean, I did a fair amount of research, but that was the kind of research where you were reading for a detail that you wanted to steal rather than a single coherent narrative. I mean, I would have been very nervous to write a colonial narrative for a country that has its own writers and its own stories and its own distinct history. So yeah, I think it allows a kind of a freedom that then means you can invest more heavily in. I mean, I think you have to really take care when you're writing about a specific political, historical situation. I think you have a responsibility, even and particularly in fiction.
So the ahistorical mode of this book actually freed you from that responsibility.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. It was part of the project always because I had felt so strongly that the kind of historical narrative was falling apart in our hands, that you were seeing it in so many ways through digital culture, through, you know, mashups, all these, and I wanted to write something that would be historical and, I mean, historical rather than period, which is a distinction that I have slightly invented, I think, but historical in the sense that it would be about history as opposed to period, which to me would mean just being set in the past. Because from the beginning I wanted to write something that was about history and something that would feel like it was contemporary sense of how historical narrative is changing, meant that it would be more ahistorical. Does that make sense?
Yes. I think that in the interests of moving from a wet narrative, because we are talking in the rain, to a dry narrative, I think I'm going to put this conversation to a close.
But this
is fine. But you know, Katie, pleasure to chat with you. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Because you can't. You won't. And you don't stop. Oh, when you can't. You won't. And you don't stop. Mike D coming down.